Talk given Saturday, 8th February, 1975. People throughout the world live the religious life in different ways. The vast mass of human beings, whatever their faith may be, live very conventionally and mechanically. They go to church or to the temple or participate in the ordinary way in the religious ceremonies which characterize the religious practice of that particular faith. To them, usually, the religious life means something quite different from the secular life. Everyday life, whether private and domestic, or public and in the world of business or affairs of state or whatever they may be, to them, these are quite different things. They try to observe some of the simple moralities which they are taught by their parents, their teachers, the priest, or whoever it may be. To observe those, they try to observe those moralities in their secular life. You and I know only too well how far the mass of people succeed in doing that. Because the living of the moralities is something so profound, so all-embracing, so transforming as far as the nature of the person himself is concerned, that people just do not understand what it means to live the moralities. Then there is that other group of people, much smaller in number, who are concerned about religion and the religious life seriously. They are more serious with their studies, more genuine, earnest with regard to their devotions, private and public, more interested and distressed if they cannot discover the truth which they want to find out, more interested in the deep inner meanings of the great religious teachings, particularly those which have a mystical expression. Up to a point they understand that the great religious teachings are expressions of the perfect psychological understanding of the great founders and of the great spiritual teachers. Those people knew the human heart and mind in perfection. That is, the founders knew these things, simply because they themselves were exemplars of perfect human living. For them to live humanly meant to live the holy life, to live the religious life, meant to live the human life in perfection. And so in their teachings, this complete understanding of the human mind and heart is embodied. But it is embodied in the language of mortals who are not perfect, who have not realized perfect humanity. Therefore, there is always a difficulty in understanding the language which they used, just as they themselves had difficulty in finding language to express this perfect vision and this perfect understanding. But there is that group, a minority in the world, which is seriously concerned with religion. This group, of course, has to contend with its own conditioning and the limitations imposed upon understanding the inner reality, the inner meaning of the teachings because of this conditioning. There is not a single one of us in the world who can escape this conditioning. The conditioning has to be there. But those who were serious enough, and perhaps also one may say, who were fortunate enough to come across teachers or circumstances, or perhaps gifted by God or nature, if they were gifted with that kind of genius, they were able to penetrate into the depths because they understood that they had to become fully acquainted with the nature of their conditioning. And in becoming acquainted with the nature of that conditioning, they were able to make sufficient allowance in order to be free of the limitations imposed by that conditioning. And then, of course, those who did not get that far always had this problem. Because, I'm talking of this second group, because they had to relate their longing to live the religious life, their understanding of the deep truths of religion and the significance and implications of religious teaching and religious living, they had to relate all this to their ordinary, everyday, secular life in circumstances which on the whole were, and particularly in our own times, are considerably obstructive to the living of the religious life. So they seek the solution to this problem. You have often heard me say, and you all know yourselves, that the true resolution of any difficulty, any problem, cannot come from the plane on which the problem exists. It has to come from a transcendent depth, something which has an overriding influence and power over the conflicts which are present in that problem and in the situation which is the problem. But this transcendent depth is not something which is separate from the plane of the problem. It is the plane of the problem subsumed within this transcendent plane, and because it is subsumed in this transcendent plane, which is a purifying and an integrating force, the problem is resolved. There is a resolution of the problem, which means that there is nothing constituting that problem which is discarded, which is destroyed, or from which you run away. You transform every element constituting the problem. And in the sphere of religion, the context of religion being transcendence itself, in the sphere of religion, this applies in supreme measure as in no other field of our ordinary human experience and life. This is very important. Now, if we really care for the religious life, which means that the whole of our life is the truly human life, if we really care, we naturally inquire, well, what is this marvelous magic, this transcendent something, which will effect this resolution, bring it about? I'm going to use a word with a very loaded meaning. And I'm going to present aspects of it somewhat arbitrarily. But bear with me, and perhaps together we might see some light. This word is a word which has been on the lips of man throughout the ages. You all know it. A monosyllable. Love. But who knows the meaning of love? Do you know it? Do I know it? Know it with the brain? Is love something which can be known analytically, intellectually? And yet not one of us can deny that the reality of love is experienceable. It is totally experienceable. It is transcendently experienceable. And it is precisely that which completely defeats all definition, all description, because that which is transcendent is infinite, and the infinite cannot be held in the cup of description, which is necessarily finite, or of definition. There is that something in us which has this divine possibility, this divine sensitivity, which goes totally beyond all our own limitations. And because of that, we can experience it, and we can experience it in fullness. Now, I want to suggest something of the arbitrary aspect of love as I am presenting it. The living of the moralities, the simple, in Buddhist terms, the silas, in Judeo-Christian terms, the commandments, in Zarathustrian terms, the good law. And so on. It's in all the religions. See? These moralities we all know verbally. But their fulfillment, as I said a little bit earlier, is something which is outside our normal experience. Now, love means these moralities in practice. When they reach their perfection in practice, their true fulfillment in practice, each and every one of these moralities is the one great spiritual value, love. There is another way in which I would like to put it before you. That is, in the word in the term purification of heart and mind. The complete purification of the mind. We know the flaws of the mind. Ambitions, the greeds, the violence, the self-centeredness, the egoism and vanity and all the rest of it. And at a more purely intellectual level, our biases, our prejudices, our preconceptions, our assumptions, our so-called eternal verities, which are formulated in words by our conditioned minds and therefore really cease to be eternal verities, all these are the deficiencies, the illnesses of the mind. Now, when purification of the mind takes place, all these fixations, these hard and fast thought forms dissolve away like mists, like morning mists before the risen sun. And then the mind is empty. Not that you and I become vacuous, stupid, idiotic. But when the mind is emptied, it is emptied of all ill. And when it is emptied of all ill, it has come to its natural state at last. And its natural state is the state of completely awakened intelligence, which perceives immediately the truth of things. To whatsoever that type of mind pays attention, it knows the truth of it there. And it knows it in terms which are beyond words and thoughts, ideas, conceptions, and so on. Not that ideas, conceptions, and words will disappear, but they will be the lowest, the meanest. I don't mean these words derogatorily, but the lowest and meanest types of expression of that intelligence functioning freely. And you will find that when intelligence functions that way, love reigns in you, through you, and spreads out to your environment immeasurably, without let or hindrance. And for the first time, awake, alive, here and now, you will experience the truth of love. So you will see why I said that I am using the word, this loaded word, in a slightly arbitrary way. But if these things aren't there, then love is something which still remains outside our experiencing. Now, in relation to all this, I want to read to you something which modern science itself has found out through years of research, verified it with numberless experiments. You may have read this book, Supernature, yourselves. By Dr. Lyle Watson. It's one of the remarkable books of the century, insofar as it presents for our consideration the work of great scientists throughout the world, along lines many of which are of special interest to us. And when I have finished reading, you will see why I have read this, or we will begin to see why I am reading this, and the relationship of this to what I have said earlier. On a February morning in 1966, Cleve Baxter made a discovery that changed his life and could have far-reaching effects on ours. Baxter was at that time an interrogation specialist who left the CIA to operate a New York school for training policemen in the techniques of using the polygraph or lie detector. This instrument normally measures the electrical resistance of the human skin. But on that morning, he extended its possibilities. Immediately after watering an office plant, he wondered if it would be possible to measure the rate at which water rose in the plant from the root to the leaf by recording the increase in leaf moisture content on a polygraph tape. Baxter placed the two PGR electrodes, PGR stands for psychogalvanic reflexes. Baxter placed the two PGR electrodes on either side of a leaf of Dracaena mesengiana, a potted rubber plant, and balanced the leaf into the circuitry before watering the plant again. There was no marked reaction to this stimulus. So Baxter decided to try what he calls the threat to well-being principle, a well-established method of triggering emotionality in humans. In other words, he decided to torture the plant. First of all, he dipped one of its leaves into a cup of hot coffee, but there was no reaction. So he decided to get a match and burn the leaf properly. At the instant of this decision, at 13 minutes and 55 seconds of chart time, there was a dramatic change in the PGR tracing pattern in the form of an abrupt and prolonged upward sweep of the recording pen. This is what Baxter himself has written. I had not moved or touched the plant, so the timing of the PGR pen activity suggested to me that the tracing might have been triggered by the mere thought of the harm I intended to inflict on the plant. Baxter went on to explore the possibility of such perception in the plant by bringing some live brine shrimp into his office and dropping them one by one into boiling water. Every time he killed a shrimp, the polygraph recording needle attached to the plant jumped violently. To eliminate the possibility of his own emotions producing this reaction, he completely automated the whole experiment so that an electronic randomizer chose odd moments to dump the shrimp into hot water when no human was in the laboratory at all. The plant continued to respond in sympathy to the death of every shrimp and failed to register any change when the machine dropped already dead shrimp into the water. Impressed by the plant's apparent sensitivity to stress, Baxter collected specimens of other species and discovered that a philodendron seemed to be particularly attached to him. He no longer handles this plant with anything but the greatest care, and whenever it is necessary, Bob Henson plays the heavy. Bob Henson is his assistant. Plays the heavy is a slang term for is nasty to the plant. Now, the plant produces an agitated polygraph response every time Henson comes into the room and seems to relax when Baxter comes near or even speaks in an adjoining room. Enclosing the plant in a Faraday screen or a lead container has no effect, and it seems, that is to say, it had no effect in interfering with the reactions of the plant. And it seems that the signals to which it responds do not fall within the normal electromagnetic spectrum. In more recent experiments, Baxter has found that fresh fruit and vegetables, mold cultures, amoebae, paramecia, yeast, blood, and even scrapings from the roof of a man's mouth all show similar sensitivity to other life in distress. This phenomenon, which Baxter calls primary perception, has been substantiated by repetition of his work in other laboratories. It raises awesome biological and moral questions. Since thinking about it, I for one, that is the writer of this book, I for one have had to give up mowing lawns altogether. But if it were to be taken to its logical limits, we would end up like the community in Samuel Butler's Erewhon, eating nothing but cabbages that have been certified to have died a natural death. The answer to the moral problem lies in treating all life with respect and killing with real reluctance only that which is necessary for survival. But the biological problems are not as easily resolved. Now, I think this is an extraordinarily significant fact. And there are many scores and scores of facts of a similar nature recorded in this book, which is the result of scientific work done by people who have no sort of special vested interest in supporting a particular kind of morality or a religious view or anything at all. They were just observing the facts as they take place every day, every hour, every moment throughout the whole of nature. Now here, if I may so put it, is a manifestation of love throughout all creation. It is a manifestation which takes place, as one might say, naturally. Nature, apart from us humans, doesn't seem to have the power of choice which will definitely say, I will discard moral values and be cruel for the sake of my pleasure or my advancement or my status or whatever it is. Nature is a miraculous interconnected web created by, sustained and nourished by love in some form or other. How extraordinary that, I'm not speaking derogatorily, a mere leaf can be so sensitive, can be constituted, just naturally constituted, of a sensitivity which will record distress at pain inflicted anywhere. Is it not an object lesson for us? An object lesson that should go home right into the inmost core of our beings, and if it did, it will waken up our intelligence. If it goes into the inmost core of our beings, it will have completely transcended emotionality. It will be calm. It will be strong. It will be utterly true. Nature can do this. Can I, who am supposed to be a human being, a member of a species which has produced humans who have said God is love? And how much have we humans understood that? Now there's a very interesting point in relation to this. The outstanding expression of love is perhaps harmlessness. Sri Krishna in the Gita, when speaking to Arjuna of the virtues which characterize the Holy One, the true human, starts off with harmlessness. It's in one of the later discourses towards the end of the Gita. In the moralities, the sealers in Buddhism, the very first one is the advice from the Buddha himself, who was called the Lord of compassion and love, of compassion and wisdom. Abstain from harming all living creatures. In the Judeo-Christian commandments, after the first five, which deal with our relationship with God and the transcendent, and with what are symbolically termed our father and our mother, honor thy father and thy mother, in order that the days, that thy days in the land which the Lord giveth thee may be long, and so forth. After the first five, thou shalt not commit any murder, the first one. And that is, of course, the most dramatic expression of harming others. You see, this virtue of harmlessness has been stressed, emphasized in every religion. In the Buddhist texts, we find more explicit statements about harmlessness. In this discourse, this long discourse, the Brahmajala Sutta, the Buddha is talking about himself. I have read this to you before, you all know it, but it can bear repetition numberless times. He starts off with the first, putting away the killing of living things, Gotama holds aloof from the destruction of life. He goes on to say, he has laid aside the cudgel and the sword, and ashamed of roughness, and full of mercy, he dwells compassionate and kind to all creatures that have life. He goes on a little later to say, Gotama the recluse holds himself aloof from causing injury to seeds or plants. I have forgotten the exact reference, so I couldn't look for it, but I believe I have read somewhere in the discourses about how some people, when they are walking through woodlands, have a habit of using their walking stick to slash away at leaves and branches or grass and destroy it, hurt it. Now, when one first comes across something like this, one feels, oh, these people, they did go to extremes. And even in this book, Supernature, you notice that Lyell Watson talks about killing only for survival. But the great teachers went further than that, because they were not egocentered. They were not self-oriented. They respected and valued and loved life more than anyone else in the world. But they were perfectly prepared to relinquish life, their own life, and not be concerned about their personal survival. This is a very important point. We will do evil in the ultimate if we are sufficiently provoked or sufficiently cornered in order that we ourselves may survive. Have we not traveled all the way to the peak point of heaven, almost to the peak point of heaven, and then suddenly dropped into hell again because the self intervened? Because we clung to life? If we are free from this clinging to life, really free in our minds, in our innermost consciousness, we'd be totally free of the fear of death. And if we are totally free of the fear of death, we shall find that our problems in connection with living the religious life in a worldly circumstance which is so obstructive to the religious life will naturally dissolve away. Let us look at something else. We all know, for instance, how Jesus said, if a man smites thee on one cheek, turn the other. About laying down your life, no man hath greater love than this, that he'll lay down his life for his friends. The Buddha said the identical thing in those very words 5 centuries previously. You will find it in the 3rd volume of the Long Discourses. And in teaching his disciples, he said this: monks, even if low-down thieves might carve you limb from limb with a double-handled saw, yet even then, whoever sets his mind at enmity, he for this reason is not a doer of my teaching. Herein, monks, you should train yourselves thus. Neither will our minds become perverted, nor will we utter an evil speech, but kindly and compassionate will we dwell, with a mind of friendliness, void of hatred. And beginning with him, that is, the person who is harming us, or trying to harm us. Beginning with him, we will dwell having suffused the whole world with a mind of friendliness that is far-reaching, widespread, immeasurable, without enmity, without malevolence. This is how you must train yourselves, monks. And then there is a very interesting discourse in which the Buddha visits 3 of his disciples, one of whom was a very great one indeed, who had gone far. His name was Anuruddha, and he was with 2 others in retreat, in meditation, in practicing the discipline of the religious life, Nandiya and Kimbila. And to Anuruddha he speaks, thus when he meets him. I hope that things are going well with you, Aniruddha. I hope you are keeping going, that you are not short of food. Things are going well, Lord. We are keeping going, and we are not short of food. I hope, Aniruddha, you are living all together on friendly terms and harmonious as milk and water blend, regarding one another with the eye of affection. As milk and water blend. You can't separate them once you've mixed them. That type of friendliness. Yes, certainly, Lord, we are living together on friendly terms and harmonious, as milk and water blend, regarding one another with the eye of affection. And how is it that you are all living together on such terms? As to this, Lord, replies Aniruddha, it occurred to me. Indeed, it is a gain for me, it is well gotten by me, that I am living with such fellow Brahma-farers. A Brahma-farer is the one who is living the holy life. On account of this, Lord, for these venerable ones, friendliness as to acts of body, whether openly or in private, has risen up in me. Friendliness as to acts of speech, whether openly or in private, has risen up in me. Friendliness as to acts of thought, whether openly or in private, has risen up in me. Consider the significance of this. They never, and the other two answer in the same way when the Buddha asks them. Consider the significance of this. Do I, in my daily life, utter speech that is always friendly, that is not harshly critical, not condemnatory? Not impatient? Do I in my daily life live in such a manner that I never get entangled in a deadly fantasy of violence and hate against a particular person, against a situation? How easily we fall into this all day and every day. You see the meaning of morality. Harmlessness. Loving kindness. To be humane. And the same with acts of body. If you and I, and you are the whole world, I am the whole world. If you and I can really live thus, what happens to the whole mass of terrible problems, politically, economically, socially, and all the rest of it? Consider the evil of the world today. And we are unwise enough to go against the evil, to fight it. Jesus said, resist not evil. Now you understand why. Transform the evil in one's own being, and one is a permanent influence, like the sun radiating heat and light and life. One is a permanent influence for good, and you can't do a greater good than that for the world or for yourself. But you see, I particularly mention the Buddhist teaching in some detail for the very simple reason that the phrase used in connection with Buddhist teaching, the middle way, has been, of course, beautifully misunderstood and mistranslated as linking my left arm with the devil, with my right arm with God, and just compromising between the two. That is not the middle way. The middle way is the way of the supreme austerity, the supreme perfection. Have no illusions whatsoever about that. We are so conditioned by our somewhat misconception with regard to Aristotle's golden mean that we have interpreted it as compromise, and we apply it in the sphere of religion, which is the context of transcendence and not of conflicting, unreconciled, opposing duality. Now, Anuruddha goes on. Because of this, because the friendliness has risen up, it occurred to me, now suppose that I, having surrendered my own mind, should live only according to the mind of these venerable ones. So I, Lord, having surrendered my own mind, am living only according to the mind of these venerable ones. Lord, we have diverse bodies, but assuredly only one mind. The extraordinary significance of these things. You see, what the power of goodness means. I have surrendered my own mind. And the mind, what is the content of the mind? Until one has realized full humanhood, what is the content of the mind? It is mainly one's own desires, which are self-oriented and self-centered. One's own ambitions. One's own greed. And all the rest of it. And it has as its root the fundamental ignorance, which means being conscious of existence, the totality of existence, which is only a one totality, in terms of you and me, the not-self and the self. And so long as one's innermost consciousness suffers from this disease, the supreme disease afflicting mankind, there is no hope whatsoever for bringing about a human society on this globe. People will say, very well, supposing we strive to do that, but then what will run our machines and deal with our political and economic problems? You will not have any political and economic problems if we all were human beings. And then you will see the miracle take place. All day and every day, love will run the machines. And the human worker will not be shackled by the machines, bored, distraught, driven wild and made savage, so that he turns against his fellow human beings and destroys them and hurts them. Love will run the machines far more efficiently than the mass of subhumans who populate this globe. This is not wishful thinking. This is not starry-eyed idealism. This is simple fact. A fact not to be argued about, because argument is waste of time. Consider it in the quiet, with a calm mind, with a heart at rest, and watch, just watch how it works in everyday life. Watch, and watch with loving kindness in your own heart, so that the pain that comes, inevitably comes, will be absorbed by your own soul, transformed from within, and sent out as a healing power of love over the whole world.